Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy O's.
Everybody, Shane Terrio here. How's everybody doing? I'm doing good, thanks for asking. Out here in sunny Southern California, you're listening to a track from my record called Dirty Power. That's the title track, Dirty Power. All right, a couple of announcements before we get to today's special guest. T-shirts, Riff Raff t-shirts. You asked for them, you got them. They're up on my website, ShaneTerrio.com. If you go to the store, you'll see merchandise, and then the t-shirts are conveniently located there. There's about three or four new, you can get all kinds of colors, and there's a couple of new designs. They're really great. I had a lot of people order them so far. I apologize if you order like a 2XL or 3XL. Those take longer. It's harder to source those right now. I guess the coronavirus is to blame for even triple XL t-shirts. I don't know why. Also, you know, consider signing up on my website. It's free. I also have a little extra membership if you like. I share little lessons and clips from backstage and blah, blah, blah. If you get a chance, I would appreciate you go to iTunes. Give me a like. Comment would be better. A good comment. And, nothing else. Enjoy the conversation today with special guest KK Downing. Let's get to it. Thank you. And my guest today is Mr. KK Downing, one of the co-founders and original guitar player for arguably one of the greatest heavy metal bands of all time. Not arguably, they are one of the greatest heavy metal bands of all time, Judas Priest. But also KK's new project, KK's Priest, a band which continues his legacy. You're listening to a tune right now called Return of the Sentinel, which is a nod to the original Sentinel, which I believe is on the Defenders of the Faith record. I could be mistaken, but Screaming for Vengeance and Defenders of the Faith are two of my faves, and this new record continues in that line, really heavy. So, and also, real quick, you might want to check out KK's book, Heavy Duty, Days and Nights, and Judas Priest. I read that before we did this interview, and really recommend it. Here we go, without further ado. The one and only KK Downing. New record is called Sermons of the Sinner, KK's Priest.
I understand you're a fellow guitar player, Shane.
That's right. Honored to talk to you, KK. I've been a fan for a long time.
Yeah.
Welcome me to Riff Raff. I know I have a lot of guitar players that, you know, maybe we'll be a little more guitar centric in this interview, because there's a lot of things I never knew about you guitar wise, so maybe we could answer a few things.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I want to talk about KK's Priest for sure, but congratulations on your record. I know it just came out and I think last week, right? Finally.
Yes.
Yeah. Finally. So congrats on that.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah. I mean, as a guitar player, you know, I don't think you ever really got your due. I think some of that is probably because, you know, you were in a guitar duo with Glenn Tipton. And I think probably the time, you know, the decades of the 70s, 80s, it was such a guitar centric thing. You know, you had Eddie Van Halen and these people, and I think you were kind of a package. So maybe you didn't get your due, but yeah. I have a lot of people that, you know, a lot of listeners that, you know, myself included, are big fans.
I definitely should have done more, you know, because obviously, you know, I had the capabilities to do it. But Glenn seemed to just somehow, it can happen in band, it can just happen. I just kind of missed it along the way, really, you know. But, you know, maybe I was always expecting Glenn just to say, well, you know, but you know, the longer solo, because we used to divide the solos up at the end of the record. Okay, we're near the end of the recording, you know. You do the solo on this song, I'll do the solo.
I was curious how that happened. Yeah,
I always ended up with the shorter solos, you know, and I always ended up with the solos that were more difficult to solo over because they weren't like your standards, you know, E, C, and D or something, you know what I mean, right, or G, C, right. And E. You know, I would get the ones like the song in Sinner where it was just E and D. So I'm working with two notes. There's an N. I'm working with two notes, you know. I've got the minor key of E and I've got the seventh. So I've got the root note in the seventh to work with. So I need to solo over that. But because, and I was aware of that at the time, but the thing is, I'm such a guy that's up for a challenge, you know. I'm up for a musical challenge. I've got to entertain people and I've got this to play over, you know. And so I kind of liked that challenge, even to the point where I thought, right, I'm going to play this live and I'm just going to play an improvised solo. And I did that in the studio as well. And so I kind of like these challenges, you know. But I kind of got the more difficult songs, part of the more difficult songs to solo over.
Well, in your book, you know, I know you're a big Hendrix fan. You said you got to see Hendrix like four or five times, and it's really a great part of your book. But I'm curious because you said you made a conscious attempt to, you know, you didn't want to go down the blue. I'm talking strictly as your formative years as a guitar player. You didn't want to go strictly. Everybody was blues, blues, blues. And who else were you listening to? And did you have any, how did you learn? Because you don't really talk about that. I never heard, did you have any, there was no tablature, there was no YouTube in those days. I mean, were you just listening to records or?
Yeah, it was insane, really. It was insane when I was young trying to do this, you know. Because, in fact, it wasn't until just a few years ago now, I had Robert, because Robert, he actually lives not too far from me and always has done. But I heard him on a local radio station and he mentioned it then. He said, you know, back in the old days, we didn't have anything to record on when we were writing songs. We just used to have to play it that many times and just hope somebody would remember it the next day. And that's what happened. That's exactly what happened. You know, I'm thinking, and I've forgotten all about that.
We didn't have an answer machine. You ever call your own answer machine?
We didn't have anything to record on. We just had to remember it. we had to remember it, you know, make sure we played it enough times to remember how the riff went the next day.
What a concept. what a concept that was.
We didn't have any of those things. That was kind of insane. But like say, I grew up in the 60s and I was asked to join a pop band, which I wanted to join because to try and make some money, you know. I was only about 17, something like that. And they would give me sheet music to learn the songs, you know.
Right.
The pop songs. But I had a record a turntable, and obviously you just put the LP on, you keep playing the record, you know, and trying to learn it. But then I would obviously refer to the sheet music as well, as best I could. I was slow. I wasn't a prolific reader, but I did that quite a bit. And then later on, I used some sheet music, trying to learn some songs that I wanted to learn, you know, and it was obscure. It was like my girlfriend had this Leonard Cohen album, you know, and it was back in the 60s. And I was interested. I was interested to learn some of these songs, which I did. In fact, I learned them all from the sheet music. The one that's got like Suzanne on and all of that. Jitterman, I can't remember the other titles. But I was interested in his right-hand finger-picking technique. And I was really glad that I did that, because I actually became, I kept that with me all my life, you know, the different right-hand finger-picking techniques from that album.
Wow, that's really interesting. I would have never guessed that.
Yeah, so I did. I learned all of those. And so, like say, I don't have a guitar here, but, you know, I was kind of interested in the combinations, different combinations that he was using, you know, more so than the chord structures, you know. And so I've kept that with me, and that's held me in good stead through life, to be honest, you know. So I did that, and then, you know, and then at some point I just essentially played by ear. But what I did, because of getting into, you know, I was kind of swimming, because I didn't want to be a blues player, you know what I mean? I liked the blues, but I knew that there was a style of music around that hadn't been invented yet. That's the truth of it. Because in like 1965, I heard the Kinks play You Really Got Me, and I liked it. And I thought, why do I like this song? This is a pop band. They're in the charts. But I liked that song. I liked the Troggs, You Really Got Me. Jimi Hendrix straight away with Purple Haze, Foxy Lady. These riff-orientated songs really got to me, you know. And even like Wild Thing. Why did I like the Troggs? Because I like Wild Thing, you know. And then later, these artists, these heavy metal artists, you know, like I saw in 1978, I saw Van Halen support Black Sabbath in Birmingham, and they played You Really Got Me, you know, and I'm thinking, that's why I like this song back in 1965, because this is a rock, hard rock, heavy rock, or heavy metal, or somewhere in between, you know, but I had that, So I wanted to hear more of this music in the 60s when I was a teenager. So the only way to do it was to create it myself. And straight away, I sat down with Alan Atkins and we wrote songs, you know, which became, you know, Victim of Changes and all of these songs, Winter and Cheater and Never Satisfied and Run of the Mill and Dreamer Deceiver and all of these songs, you know. And I have recordings of us playing these songs as a four piece, you know. And then when Rob joined, we played them. We did a lot of shows, you know. But we never had any recordings. But I've got one record. But there's a few bits around. But you see, and then when people used to book us as a band, nobody could say what style of music we played. So they used to call us a progressive blues band. Tonight, Judas Priest, progressive blues band. I'm going, okay. Because we didn't even have rock bands back then, you know, as a point in the 60s. We had rock and roll, but we didn't want to be rock and roll. That was Bill Haley and Elvis. But when 1970 came, we had rock bands like Led Zeppelin, you're a rock band. Deep Purple, now you're a rock band, you know. And then we got labeled as a rock band, then a hard rock band, then a heavy metal, and then a heavy rock band, and then a heavy metal. So this evolution, this journey that I was on, was coming good all the time, really. It was getting there, it was getting there, it was getting there, you know.
Yeah,
creating this music that didn't really have its own identity or label. In fact, people were so unsure about what we were doing. It kept changing, didn't it? You know, because one minute we're a hard rock band. No, Judas Priest, you're a heavy rock band. No.
Well, it's always been heavy. And you know, I'm sure you've seen it, but the Reading Festival 1975 is on YouTube, some 8mm clip. And it's just amazing to watch that and hear it. I mean, there's nobody that heavy back then. I mean, Sabbath, you know, but that's it. And and to see you're both playing SGs too, which was amazing.
And back then, you see, what happened was most of the progressive blues bands usually wore denim, you know, a lot of the times, a lot of bands. And they were great. We had so many great bands, didn't we? You know, from, you know, Rory Gallagher, Free, you know, Blodwyn Pig, Jethro Tull. I mean, it went on and on and on, the list of the bands, you know, Savoy Brown, you know, it went on. It was relentless and they were all great, wonderful artists. But there was people like me and other people around the world, probably of a similar age, we had a different idea. And so when I first heard Black Sabbath, I went, fuck, great. Thanks for that. I'm so happy. It wasn't exactly what I had in mind, but at least there's other bands, you know.
Right.
There's other guys that have got a similar kind of thing in their mind, and there must have been other people, you know, around the world. Probably Frank Marino and other people, you know, had a different thing going on, which was good. And so that encouraged me, really, to get on to... Because you've got to have great encouragement to persevere and spend your whole life creating something. And you don't know because it's such an unknown entity,
right,
whether it's actually going to be a saleable item, you know, or whether people are just going to flush it down the toilet. So you carry on and you carry on and you carry on. But
One of the things I always admired about Priest. I mean, with Stained Class was, what, 78, 79, and you guys never, what was going on at that time, punk and disco. I mean, you never wavered and never changed throughout genres. I mean, Nirvana and grunge, and you still were metal. That's what I always loved about Priest and what you're doing now. It's the same. It's just you by yourself, you know.
But as a musician, the only thing I know is that I really adhered. I didn't adhere myself to the minor and major pentatonic, because that's the formula that blues players, you know, will, you know, it should go to. So I didn't go there. I went straight to the natural minor scale. You know, that was it, because that incorporates those scales anyway, but I've got the extra notes to play with.
Sure.
So kind of that's what I always did, you know. And then, you know, playing by ear, you go to other scales as well, you know, even chromatic, you know, obviously diminished, and you go into a few other territories as well. You've naturally got pentatonic stuff in there as well, because you naturally go there. But I was kind of, everything to me was kind of, and still now I'm very, very much a dear, very much so. I like to obviously intertwine and integrate different scales now, because that's a load of fun now. You know, since the 80s, I entered into that. I'm thinking I need to sharpen the tools up a little bit here, you know, and start to get into harmonic minor and whole tone, half tone, and, you know, the Phrygian and all the modes, and learn, you know. I'm always curious as to why modes are so complicated to so many. If I give a tutorial one day, obviously, the modes is a scale within a scale, you know.
It's the same notes. It's just, starting on different notes.
You just start and finish on a different one. Yeah. Why is it so
complicated? It's just the context of the actual mode, if you Yeah, they're like, I look at them like flavors or colors, I guess, you know. But
it's even, well, I mean, without getting too complicated, but even like a double harmonic major scale, you know, you still get modes within that scale. You just start on a different note. And then, so maybe I'll just do something. At some
that would
point.
Be great. Yeah.
But
Downing, that would be, I'd buy it.
But you know, why do, you know, because I grew up in the early 70s, obviously. I mean, that album, Deep Purple and Rock, was a great album, but I was a big early, very, very early Scorpions and very early UFO fan, you know, because I thought that, you know, obviously very good guitar players. And, but I simply liked what they were doing song-wise, really, you know. And, so I was a big fan there, and I actually, with those bands, I actually heard more, you know, comprehensively movements within the Aeolian scale than I did, you know, just the basic pentatonic.
I thought maybe we could talk about how you came up with some of the riffs on Sermons of the Sinner. I mean, your approach to songwriting, I'm interested in that because I know maybe back in the Priest days when the budgets facilitated, you know, you guys camping out in the studio and writing more in the studio as opposed to now where everything's more internet-based. I mean, how did you approach writing some of these riffs?
Yeah, I think I just went, Shane, you know, I just sat down Christmas. It was virtually Christmas Day on 2019, you know, and, you know, and just shut myself away. I live on my own. Don't have a family, just my mom and a couple of sisters, two sisters. Mm-hmm. And I thought that I'll just sit down and put an album together. And I just went on to autopilot. You know, for somebody like me, after all of these years in the business, for me to just go on to autopilot wasn't really a difficult thing to do. I mean, I did have the help, obviously, as guitar players. We always carry now, obviously, with computers, a catalogue of ideas. A lot of stuff's been discarded, thrown out. Your bandmates didn't like it, you know, or whatever, but maybe you always thought it was a decent idea, you know. But so I took a couple of things from there, you know, but not much really, because I just came up essentially with song titles, working titles, and a sentiment to go with that title, you know, which enabled me to put, you know, some lyrical ideas, right, you know, down. And also, if I do like vocal melodies, I tend to go with the first ones that I come up with, which is probably going to be the most kind of obvious and commercial ones, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I often use that. If I come up with a melody line, I don't tend to milk it and work it too much to make it more intricate or fancy or anything. I tend to just go with it if it delivers up what you want it to. And also, to be honest, between, you know, obviously you're a musician as well. I didn't want to stress myself out trying to come up with musical ideas, you know, for the vocal parts, musical ideas that were too kind of, not complicated, but clever or, do you know what I mean, musically right. more... You know what I mean? Because you know what it's like. So if you leave, sometimes ideas are a little bit more simplistic, you know, cool, but less complicated, leaves a lot more room for vocal melodies, for orchestration on the top, doesn't it, Shane?
Sure.
Yeah. So to move about more, you know the way it is. If the guitar part's going like this, up and down and up and down, it's hard for the vocals to fit in there. So I didn't want to stress myself out. And so what happened was I came up with some guitar riffs. And I'm thinking, is this good enough? Should it be more, you know, complex or whatever? But I just went with them. And the more I live with them, and then when started to put the vocals and melody lines on top, they work so well together. I'm really glad that I kept it, you know, more straightforward underneath, you know. And so using kind of those tricks of the trade and stuff like that, if all that makes
sense. It makes absolute sense. And, you know, one of the genius things that I always loved about Priest were, even on a record like Rock-A-Roller, where the guitar sounds weren't necessarily really saturated. It was just always that heaviness. And I think I read somewhere where you were talking about the concept of light and shade, maybe.
Yeah.
When writing and leaving space. I mean, maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, definitely light and shade. We used to call it that years ago, you know, from day one almost, really. But certainly in the early 70s, when we were putting albums together, you know, because what happens is that I think it's fair to say it's hard to listen to the same intensity, for example, for a whole album. Like if you had 10 painkillers on a song,
right,
it would be hard to listen
to. Yeah, painkillers, you know, pretty heavy. Yeah.
You want to give the listener a bit of a break and take them on a journey. You know, it's a bit of a roller coaster. And light and shade, I guess we talk about the intensity, you know. So we need certain ingredients. We need the tempo changes. So we need, I mean, you could take the great classic albums of all time, you know. If you have Deep Purple in Rock, you've got Speaking, but you've got Child in Time, you know, and you've got medium-paced songs. So it's kind of a formula that kind of we always kind of worked to, really. Mm-hmm. And it still works today. And I do believe that that's the case, you know, because when you bring it down, and it's like a live performance, when you put a set list together, you take that into consideration as well, right. Not to pound the listener, you know, for 20 minutes nonstop. You have to pull and push. And like you say, we call it light and shade. So that is pretty important as well.
Future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
But going back to some of the basics as well, when you want to create some of those songs, like on Sermons of the Sinner, with songs like Brothers of the Road, Raise Your Fists, and Wild and Free, songs that are kind of comparable to other parking lot songs, I might want to call those, you know, or call them driving songs, whatever you want to call them, comparables like Living After Midnight, you know, Breaking the Law, Hot Rocking, Head Out to the Highway, you know, the Living After Midnight, whatever, you know, those type of songs, they're a very important ingredient in what I feel that I've always done and probably should always do, you know, on a heavy metal album. So you got songs that are just like, yeah, we're gonna rock out, get to the parking lot, meet our mates, drink some beers, we're going to a concert tonight. That kind of up type of, you know, feeling, you know, the rebellious type of songs as well. I like to turn the clock back as well and go, I want to live those moments as well, you know. And so, we're Hellraisers, Rule Breakers, you know, even though I'm not now because I'm going to be 70 years old next month, I still like to think that I've got that ingredient inside me, whether I do it or not, just a name. But, like, obviously, I adhere to songs like that because it takes me back, you know, to a time when it did happen. And on top of that, you've got songs that are kind of more emotional, more sentiments, more meaning, you know, on the album, you know, like Return of the Sentinel or, you know, Metal Through and Through and Sermons of the Sinner, these messages, this rejoicement, this celebration, and these songs that are just, have more to say, you know, and are more orchestrated, you know.
Right, sure.
But I think that it has worked in the past, and I think it's a combination of ingredients that works really quite nicely on a kind of, you know, archetypal, traditional heavy metal album, you know. Worked for me, and it worked very well, you know, in Judas Priest, you know, on the albums that the fans seem to like the best, you know.
It's a great record, KK. Congratulations again.
Thank you, Matt.
I hate the word gear, but if you could talk about, I know in the early days, maybe that Reading Festival where you guys, I know there was limited choices as far as effects pedals and things like fuzzes, but I think you used a treble booster. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And was that pretty much it for like Rockerola or the early albums?
Honestly, like I say, I've got a couple of those old ones here. But if you get like a 50-watt Marshall, you can be 100 watts. It's just very, very loud.
Yeah.
You know, because when you just plug the treble booster in to 100 watt, it will take your head off, you know. But a 50-watt, what happened was even with the treble booster, you couldn't get enough drive, you know, on the amp. Because what happened is you drive the amp up and a 4x12, a 50-watt, right? But once you get up between 6 and 7, thereabouts, that's the optimum performance for that Birra kit. You know, if you go past it, you don't get any more volume, you just get more compression and it's unwanted. But the thing is, what happens is you've got this guitar sound and it's massive.
Mm.
And it does have a really great drive, and it'll be the best rhythm sound you ever heard in your life, you know. But both myself and Glenn used that for years and years. But the thing is, when it came down to soloing, it didn't give us what we wanted to. You didn't have the drive for the sustain that you wanted to with the solos, you know. So in the studios, we had to think again. I don't know what Glenn, I can't remember what Glenn did. But I know I had various bits of kit that were in the studio that would drive the front end a little bit more for the solos. Right. No, none of us had enough drive for solos in those. Mm-hmm. We were always looking. But the pedals that were coming out, you know, we either didn't know how to use them properly. Well, we couldn't really, because like nowadays, you can use one of those pedals that came out and you can use something like a power brake, you know, and you can get them sounding great.
Right.
But we didn't have the power brakes back then in the early 70s, you know. So it was hard to make it work. And that's why if you get somebody like Ingvar that will use a Dodd or a Ibanez Tube Screamer on the front end, he will have to crank it up so loud, you know, obviously you get all these, you know, and but then if you start to put on noise suppressors and everything like that, it starts to shrink back.
Yeah,
shrinks back. And I can just imagine him thinking, no, I want to hear those extra frequencies. Mm. And he lives and performs with that, and all credit to him. I mean, he's a master of that, you know. But we needed, being two guitar players, we needed more control. You know, if you had all these erroneous noise coming out of Glenn, I would say, Glenn, it's too, you know, we need to pull it back a little bit, you know.
Did you and Glenn both get the Pete Cornish boards at the same time?
Yes.
It must have cost a fortune back then, because they're still expensive.
Oh, mate, honestly, I've got them. I've got some of them here, you know. I've got some of them, still some of them here, but we came into money, dare I say, enough money to buy a Pete Cornish, because we thought there's only Pink Floyd and bands like that that could afford those, you know. And one day we thought, we've got to up the ante here. We've got to get something, you know. We've got to get something. And that's another massive, massive story in itself. The evolution of guitar processors and everything we know, because we were out there obviously pioneering all of this stuff, you know. And now it all gets condensed.
Right.
I think I must have been the first guitar player, or one of them, ever to have a guitar tuner on my pedal board. You know, because when that first Korg, and I've got one here, the Korg with the needle came out, I was able to put that on my pedal board and root through it. But the only problem with it, the needle was red, and with the lights, you couldn't see the needle. So I took it apart and got an ink marker and made the needle black.
Wow, that was clever.
And put it all together. And then I was able to switch it off, silence it, so I could tune on my pedal board. And of course, after a while, it all got integrated. But, you know, you remember these things, because up until then, you only had like the strobe tuners and stuff like that. And of course, you couldn't stick
Peterson's one of those. Peterson's giant one, yeah.
Yeah, all of that, you know, which I never really got into, you know.
I actually never figured out how to use one of those. I've seen guitar
jets. You know, honestly, my eyes went wonky. I've seen all things.
It's like radar.
But we've got to know and understand this in this whole world. The tuner is just a guide. The rest you have to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, my guitars now, my low E is 10 cents flat. My A is 10 cents flat. This is with me striking the note as light as I can possibly strike it, you know. Mm. So I'm 10 cents flat, 10 cents flat, 2.5 cents flat, 5 cents flat, 10 cents flat, and 15 cents flat.
Wow, that's really interesting. I've never heard of that before. Just to compensate for your right hand?
And it's wonderful.
Wow.
But then again, my strings are 8 through 38. So obviously that comes into play.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got to do it for yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So a piece of advice to all the guitar players that go out there young, don't expect to buy a guitar tuner. Tune to the tuner and expect your guitar to be tuned, you know, right. Everywhere, because it won't be.
You still have some of your Hamers, KK?
Yeah, of course. Great guitars, you know. Had a great long relationship with a Hamer.
Probably Joel, right? Joel Danzig.
Yeah. Joel's a wonderful guy, very talented guy.
He's still building great guitars today.
Yeah.
I have a few Hamers too. I think they're really unsung guitars. They were
absolute quality, because the thing is, I went to the factory a lot of time, and the main staple of what they do was their purchasing of quality timbers, but also the great big racks they had where the timbers just lay there to age.
Right.
You know, and that's a big part of it. And that's what makes a touring guitar, isn't it? Because we as guitar players, experienced guitar players, we just pick up a guitar, we think that's a touring quality guitar, or it's not.
Right.
You know?
Right.
There's a big difference, mate. And we know that.
Sure.
We do know. A lot of the parts you can change, But the main of the headstock, the neck and the body, you can't change. You're stuck with it.
Right.
And you can kind of get a feel for it, can't you? That this will. This
yeah, it feels it has a voice. It feels it's kind of alive. Yeah, it feels.
It's this will go around the world. It was, you know, and it's going to hold me in good stead.
Well, I don't want to keep you too much more. If I can ask you an oddball question, do you remember anything about the day you guys did Priest did Top of the Pops and Marie Osmond stormed into the dressing room about the Harley?
No, it wasn't the Harley. It was the bullwhip.
Oh, even better. Bullwhip.
Yeah, because we did the rehearsal, the dress rehearsal, and Rob had his bullwhip, you know, on stage. I don't know what else, but we had some props. You know us, we would grab anything.
Yeah.
Just, you know, but Rob had the bullwhip, you know, and we used to actually sell the badges. And it said, "I've been whipped by Rob Halford." And we used to sell those at the gigs, and they were a big seller.
How bad.
They were. But anyway, so we did the dress rehearsal, and then the guy came in and said, "Look, you guys can't use the bullwhip, you know, because the Osmonds have said that they won't be performing if you use the bullwhip." And so we weren't very happy about that at all. We were not happy at all. I'm thinking, you do your show and we'll do ours. Do you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
It's like, you know, I mean, okay, it's a family show, but what the hell, you know?
It's just
we're
a
on the
whip.
Show. We're on the show. And so I can remember going into makeup and Marie was in the chair next to me. She got the cucumbers on her eyes and everything, you know. And these are lovely people. I'm very talented people. Right. And Marie was very pretty. And I sat in the chair and the lady went, "Oh, yeah, you're fine. You don't need anything doing." And I felt like I was on the tip of my tongue to say something to Marie right there and then. You know what I mean? Well, look, she got the towel and the cucumbers and everything, you know. But I thought, no, I'll bite my tongue, you know. But we did have a bit of a shout and that. And we did complain after the show, you know, after the show, as you do. But you know, we're all unscathed. We did the show. Rob didn't use the whip. But, you know, I felt all the time we were doing the show that Rob would just pick something else up. I'm thinking he's going to do something. Rob is going to do. Because if he could have grabbed a fire extinguisher and let it off or anything, he would have done, you know, because... You know, I'm thinking something's going to kick off, but we got through it.
Oh, it's so great.
But well, yeah, it was the ball. It was the ball.
All right, KK. Well, thank you. And congratulations on, you know, KK's Priest. I look forward to seeing you out there. Hopefully you can do some shows soon. And everybody check out the record.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. Sermons of the Sinner.
We're ready to kick some ass, honestly.
I'll bet.
Get out there and meet our audiences, like every band does. But as soon as we can get some shows, we're going to be out there. And it will happen. It's undeniable. It's unstoppable now. The machinery is in effect, and we need to go out and do what we do. Looking forward to it.
Great. Well, it's a great record.
And good luck with you, Matt. And thank you very much. Yeah, and hope to see you out there on the road.
Thank you, KK. It's a real pleasure, man. Appreciate your time.
Thank you to you, mate, as well. Take care.
Bye-bye.
See you later.
Thank you, KK, for taking the time to chat with me. And thank you for listening. If you're still with us, check out Sermons of the Sinner, KK's Priest. See you next time on Riff Raff.
When you need need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.